Work shouldn't feel like a drag, and you shouldn't have to sacrifice your soul for a job you love. Determined to rethink the future of work, she's out of her depth on purpose. With fresh ideas, interviews, and stories from her life on the road, meet Europe's newest digital nomad, Blair Palmer.
Hello and welcome to episode 80 of A Brilliant Gamble. I hope you are really well. I am recording this introduction from a field. I'm sitting in a field, surrounded by fields. I can see a house. I won't lie to you. I can see a house, a farmhouse in the distance, but basically I can't see any other people apart from Ivy scrabbling around in the undergrowth doing something I don't know what. We have been travelling from France across back to England. We're here for a few days. I've got some work in this country and actually in France and Switzerland over the next week. So we thought we'd based ourselves in the UK so I could do that. And we are trying to work out what balance really looks like for us. I mean, to be honest, that is the name of the game for the whole trip and hopefully for the rest of our lives. But I've been struggling, I will tell you, for the last couple of weeks with balance. We have not been getting the balance right. I was saying to Ivy today that I haven't had a moment to sit and just enjoy what we're doing for at least 2 weeks. I mean, we've been out and about, we've looked at local towns and we've done some fun stuff. We went to Legoland, we've done some really good stuff. But I haven't had a chance to just sit and think and read and rest and relax. And to be honest, that's what I'm looking for. I love my work and I love working hard and I love being busy and I love the camping and going from place to place. But I also need time to rest and reflect. I think we all do. And that's why today's interview is so timely. Because we all know that feeling that we're not able to do well at our work without sacrificing our life outside of work. It's not just me. And the point is, it's not just you either. More than that, it's not your fault. According to my interviewee today, Sarah Jackson, OBE, she's the CEO of Working Families, what you're experiencing, if you have this same feeling of being out of balance, of having to make these sacrifices in order to do a good job at your work. What you're experiencing is a systemic problem to do with poor job design and the fact that the way we work does not fit with having a family, full stop. Working Families is the UK's leading work-life balance organisation. It's been around for nearly 40 years, researching and campaigning to find ways to change the way we live and work. And Sarah Jackson has been its CEO for 24 of those 40 years. This is fascinating stuff and will, I hope, help you see what's within your influence to change and what requires a bigger cultural shift if we're to find a solution that goes beyond individuals making individual arrangements, which often involves some kind of sacrifice somewhere along the line. So without further ado, let's go to the interview. Sarah, great to have you on the show. How are you today?
It's lovely to be with you and I'm feeling very good, thank you. Looking forward to talking.
Yeah, me too. I've been having a look at some of the data around working families and what it's really like. I mean, I know from my own experiences and from clients, of course, but it's fascinating to see the most recent data about how parents actually feel in the workplace. Can we just start by you giving us a kind of overview of whether we have a problem in this country, in the UK certainly, when it comes to working as a parent?
I think we have a huge problem. We've been tracking it for a number of years. The way work is organised does not fit with family life and family responsibilities. We produce an annual parent survey, which is called the Modern Families Index, which Bright Horizons supports. And that has been showing us consistently that parents are saying that work has a negative impact on family life. We see high levels of stress, work-related stress rather than family-related stress. And we see parents saying, particularly the way time is misused by work, that work steals time from their families. So it prevents them from putting children to bed, from reading to children, doing homework with children. It also interferes with their personal couple relationships, and it also interferes with their own health and well-being. So people are not getting the exercise they know they should be doing. They don't eat well, they drink too much, they smoke too much. So generally there is a picture of a mismatch between work and family.
And you're saying this is something that's getting worse?
Yes, I think it is. It's certainly not getting any better. And what parents are saying is that year on year, because we ask them, is it harder now to bring up your children than it was last year or 3 years ago? And they're consistently saying, yes, it is harder. That's partly financial as well. So they're saying the cost of bringing up children and running a family is becoming more challenging. So they've got a financial cost and a time cost. Now, financial costs are, I suppose they're going to be ever-present because people's incomes may or may not be adequate for what they're trying to achieve. We know that inflation rates are quite low at the moment, but at the same time, the costs particularly of childcare are zooming up far ahead of the rate of inflation, and wage levels have been stagnant since the recession in 2008. So people are losing ground financially against the way, you know, the cost of living in the UK. But I think almost more importantly, they're losing ground in time terms. That work is making greater and greater demands on family life in time terms, and that is what is so damaging, because you lose resilience. So if you're struggling for money but you've got control over your time, that's one set of problems. If you're cash rich, as we see many people in management and senior roles in the city, they are cash rich people, but they are absolutely time starved, and that brings its own forms of stress. So at both ends of the income scale, there is stress. And then what Miliband used to talk about, the poor old squeezed middle, they're under stress as well, because there they've got financial and time worries.
So interesting this, because I certainly feel that stress. And I mean, I run my own business, but of course I've got to make sure that there's enough income coming in to support the family. And some years that's harder than other years. But it can definitely feel quite like it's just you that's struggling. So you can look around and think, well, I don't have enough time, and I'm sacrificing time with my family, and I'm not there to help with the homework or to do the bedtime story. That's my problem. But you're actually saying this is getting to be quite universal.
This is a widespread problem. And I think you're right. I think people internalize and individualize. When we ask parents who's responsible for their work-life balance, you know, who's meant to fix it, the majority say, I have to. So they're taking responsibility for something that is structural and societal. And that way, you make yourself ill. If you're trying to fix something that you have no control over and no power around, that adds to your stress. It is interesting, though, they also are very clear, though, that they're expecting their employer to think hard and do something about work-life balance. It's just that they somehow don't seem to think that it's in the employer's power to fix it. So it still comes back to the individual. I have to fix it. Nevertheless, I'm blaming my employer for the situation I'm in. Interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, really interesting. So one of the things that you talk about in the report is poor job design. So this, in a way, comes to the heart of why you can't personally do anything about it. If you've accepted the job and then it turns out that it's a job that's not really for one person, it's a job that cannot be done within the hours that you've contracted and requires you going above and beyond evenings and weekends and holidays. How, this is something you can't do anything about. How seriously are organisations taking this particular challenge of poor job design?
Well, I'd say not very. I think the first thing to say is that everybody accepts that every now and then you have to go above and beyond. And so organisations which are getting it right, where jobs are well designed, which may be consciously, they may be looking at large jobs and thinking, how can we do this differently? I think there are also, though, a whole number of jobs which are doable. So not every job is an extreme job. So for example, someone who is working fixed shifts, they do know their time boundaries. And you're very, you know, and they also, so you have a fairness between employer and employee. People know what the time boundaries are. They are willing to do more when more is needed. It's when more has to be done all the time. And what we see is that a number of people who are working full time, a significant number, are working the equivalent of an extra day a week. And similarly, a large number of people who are working part time are consistently doing hours that means they're actually working full time. So in those cases, you've got people who are being exploited, you know, pure and simple. You can't keep up that level of pace and intensity without feeling at the very least resentful and quite possibly making yourself ill. But I think that at the root of it, we're not very good time budgeters. That businesses are used to thinking, or organizations are used to thinking about money. You know, so how do we manage this organization's money? And we report on the bottom line, we know whether we're profitable or not. Businesses don't tend, they're very transactional, so they don't tend to think about the value of time, they don't think about the value of relationships particularly. And I think we need to move ourselves into a place where our managers are trained to time budget and people budget, and therefore to start thinking, okay, what do we actually need to achieve from this role? And how is it going to be achieved? How much time will it take to achieve it? Where does this work need to be done? If you can answer all those questions, you can then design a human-shaped job, at which point you're going to see performance shooting up because people feel in control again, and they feel that there's a fairness about their relationship to you. I mean, an extreme but wonderful example of this is Pursuit Marketing, which is a little telemarketing company in Glasgow. And they, about a year and a half ago, moved on to a standard four-day week without cutting anybody's pay. So everybody's being paid for five days. They're doing 4 days, and productivity has settled down at around about 30% higher than it used to be on a five-day week. And I think that's just a brilliant example of an organization with a bit of vision and inspiration who really understand what the clients need, because, you know, they're marketing. They've got to respond fast. They can't be saying we're shut. But what they can do is they can enable their people to have the control over their time and the space in their week to give of their all when they're sitting at their desks.
It's quite a leap, isn't it? I mean, that's an amazing example, and it doesn't surprise me at all. It's just that it's quite a big leap for an organization to make, to say, we will pay our people the same, we will ask them to do fewer hours, and we will see productivity go up once things settle down. So that's such a leap into the dark compared with the current philosophy, which is that, you know, the more hours you put in, the more we're going to be able to achieve, surely. And even though you can see the harm that it's doing to your people, breaking away from that belief is, I mean, it seems to almost require a spiritual enlightenment to get to that.
It is a tremendous leap of faith, but it shouldn't be, because the evidence is so strong. And we've known it for decades that you work past about 8 hours and your productivity falls away. And there was research a few years ago that showed that for people, brain workers, people working under high pressure, so top-end lawyers, etc., they're done after 6 hours. And yet these are people who are typically being expected to put in a 10 or a 12-hour day. I mean, I look at the work done by the Agile Future Forum in the UK, and I find that really interesting and exciting, because that is where you've had a whole group, around 22 founder organizations, large and small, public and private, who really sat down and deconstructed work. So they looked at location, they looked at time, meaning when is the work to be done, how long should it take. They also looked at the kind of contract that was necessary for the work. And every single one of those organizations can show you productivity improvement. Not, you know, on a scale from about 3% up to about 30, I think, but they've all got the evidence. So we should be in a place where, as people who are running organizations or who are working within organizations, we should be able to start asking ourselves some hard questions about why we, especially, you know, in a world where we know that for most organizations, Monday to Friday, 9 to 5 is history. Even for a high street shop, what you've probably got is opening hours, which are longer because you want to catch people who are beginning and end of day, and you've got shelf stacking later. You know, very, very few people now have that old fashioned, you know, what our grandparents would have seen as a working day. And yet we still design our jobs in a kind of uniform Lego brick kind of way. Then we go, oh, doesn't work. We need more time. Well, why don't you, who I've given this Lego brick to, you just do more time then? And it makes people ill and means they don't work so well.
Yeah. And it's fascinating about the productivity. I mean, a lot of my clients would love to be getting 30% more productivity out of their people. But the strategy is to push harder and keep raising the targets and to make efficiency savings, which, of course, according to the research that you're quoting, is completely counterproductive.
Well, yes, because you're just trying to get more out of fewer people and you're putting them under greater stress. So they're going to make poorer decisions. They're going to be working faster if they're working with their hands. You know, you're just, it is completely, it's both counterintuitive and counterproductive. I mean, I think of another example, coincidentally, also from Glasgow, which is BAE Naval Ships, who looked at the shop floor. And what they've done is, I think it's so simple. They know exactly what the staff have to produce in a week. And they've then given the teams the control and they've said, this is your output. When you've finished, go home. And so again, you're seeing something that's close to a 4-day week or a bit 4.5 maybe, but very rarely are those guys working on a Friday afternoon. And yet, you know, it's all been thought through. So the profitability is there and the performance is there and the standard is there. And people have got more time with their families or more time for themselves.
One of the things in the report that I thought was really surprising was that flexible working policy doesn't necessarily bring about the kind of results that you're talking about for the individual who are expecting it to give them more flexibility, but actually it doesn't seem to do that. And for the organization, can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yes, I mean, what we have consistently said is flexible working is not a fix in itself. And so what we see is around about a third of parents who've got flexible working say that it has no impact on their work-life balance. And when you first read that, you think, whoa, that means flexible working's failed. Well, no, it hasn't. Because flexible working is merely a tool. It's merely saying, you know, maybe it gives me flexibility. Maybe it gives me the ability to manage my impossible workload at home in the evenings and at weekends, which many, many parents do. Maybe it permits me to go and sit in Starbucks and have an unsatisfactory phone call with somebody I can't really hear because I don't have time to go to the office. You know, so there's a lot of hidden bad work design there where flexible working is somehow meant to sort out poor work design. And then a lot of flexible working is, I think we go through fashions with flexible working. So at the moment, we think that flexible working means remote working. And it used to mean part-time working. It just depends, you know, who's talking loudest in a particular year. So we have to remember also that flexible working isn't necessarily flexible. It's always flexible at the point of negotiation. Once it's been agreed, quite a lot of flexible working is inflexible. Part-time hours is an obvious one. And in fact, what an awful lot of parents and people with care responsibilities want is they don't want flexibility. They want a sensible negotiation at the beginning. They want a set of hours that will work for them and for their employer. And then they want certainty. What they absolutely don't want is the kind of flexible working where they're at the beck and call of the employer, whether that means you are in retail and you're getting your shifts every weekend and you can't organise your childcare until you know what your shifts are, or whether you are working for, I don't know, an international company and you're expected to travel and you're only ever told 2 days or the day before that you've got to drop everything and go to Dubai and you've got to organize your childcare. So you can see that flexible working in itself isn't the answer. The answer is proper work design and a fair contract which thinks about time, money, and the value of my relationship within the team.
Do you think, I mean, in addition to things getting harder for working families, and this increased culture of long hours and all of that, and in addition to that, we're also seeing a change in expectations by younger workers, so that they're expecting something different? And I know you've got some data on this, particularly millennial dads, that's quite surprising, quite interesting.
I think it's more than interesting. I think it is an absolute klaxon wake-up call for UK employers, because we all have within our, I know, it's quite an atavistic sense of the ideal worker. So the ideal worker is a man. He's got a lovely wife and family at home. He's got a picture on his desk or inside his locker of his lovely children. He's the breadwinner, and he's working really hard because of that. And what we find in the Modern Families Index is that he's gone if he ever existed. Those young fathers want to have equality. So they want to be hands-on dads at home, in the same way that the young women who are their partners want to maintain a position in the workforce, whether that be a job or a career. And those young men are coming up against a working culture that doesn't see them. They're invisible. And so what we are seeing is that we have a generation of young men who are starting to make the same career compromises that women have been making for several decades. So what the index shows us is around about 17 or 18% of all the parents we spoke to said, we have actually taken steps to sort out our dissatisfying work-life balance. So we have found another job, we have turned down a promotion, we have reduced our hours, you know, practical things that you can do to take back control of your time. So far, so obvious. It's when you look at the gender split and you discover that it's almost equal between men and women. So those young men are doing the same things that 30 years ago, our generation of women started doing. And we know how that turned out in the workplace. It meant that employers had to start worrying about their talent pipelines. You know, where are the women that we expect 10 or 15 years into their careers to be ready for promotion? Oh, look, they've dropped out. They're working part-time. They've gone home. They're working below their skill set. 5 to 10 years from now, there is a similar generation of men who are going to be in that same position. And I don't think any of us as employers are thinking that one through. But it's massive that men and women together are saying, we want to change it's not just about equality, it's about saying everybody should be thinking about those years from mid-20s to mid-40s where we have to do all our parenting and all our career building at the same time. And the way we've got round that is to say women will compromise, men will carry on. Whereas now, men and women are saying compromise. And so what I'm excited about is whether that compromise will be recast by this generation into not a compromise, but the new normal, which is we will do our career building differently so that we keep pace with our family building.
I mean, it is exciting, but in a way it's also disappointing that we seem to have to wait for generational change to occur, that actually the people who are currently running the businesses, I mean, a lot of people in their 40s are running businesses, but if we think about the big companies that are run by people in their 50s, 60s, in some cases older, we're just basically waiting for those guys to move on and make space for a different generation with a different outlook in order to change the culture. Do we have to wait another 20 years?
I think about this a lot. I think it's very easy to forget what a workplace revolution has happened in the last 30 years in terms of women's participation, in terms of women at the top, in terms of flexible working, in terms of different career paths. And I think that each generation builds on the achievements of its predecessor. And so, if you like, we are currently at the tail end of the lean-in generation. And we are looking at a new generation now that's saying, well, we don't want to lean in, actually. We want to fix it. We want to make it different. And so on the one hand, you can say, yes, you know, I want to be a revolutionary. I want to make this change now because it's all wrong. On the other hand, there is the, you know, there's the parliamentary route to socialism, isn't there, where you go, you know, decade by decade, you make progress. Perhaps that's not a very good analogy. Many socialists would challenge me on it. But I think it's about rethinking, and each generation has its own take, doesn't it? And you can, you know, I can think back to leaders in the 90s. I'm talking about men here. So the leaders in the 90s who were engaging with this agenda tended to be men who were on their second families. And they were going, my kids have gone to university and I don't know them. And I've got a 2-year-old and I want to know this child. So they were being champions of a rethink, a 1990s rethink. And then we got into the new millennium, and you had a generation of leaders who had working wives, many of whom might have been leaders as well. And that gave them a very different take on it. But again, I think people also, they lead and they do things from within their own experience. And you have to be in a very, very, very bad place to really, you know, break it to make it new. Mostly what you do is you take your own experience. It's important to validate your own experience and not to say I've made wrong choices. So those leaders 10 years ago, 15 years ago, were saying, again, we can reshape this. But it was still very much leading up to the lean in moment, saying we do this from the inside and we do it on its own terms. So I think now what we've got is a generation who potentially are going to say, our terms are different. And so you think of a river meandering along the court, you know, so looping along. And then just every now and then it will cut through one of those bends. So the river will break its banks, bang, flood through, change happens. It leaves behind a very beautiful Oxbow Lake, which is stagnant. So perhaps that's the old generation of leaders. Because you do, again, I talk to people who say, yeah, we're just waiting for these people will never get it, and they'll all have retired in the next 5 years. So let's not undervalue what they've contributed. You know, their city, what they've done is great stuff, but they haven't made the change. They haven't completed the change. And I don't doubt that the new generation won't complete it either. I think what I hope is that we're entering into a century where we think much more creatively about the permeability between work and life. I mean, a criticism of work-life balance or work-life integration or work-life anything is, why is there a distinction between work and life? Because work is a huge part of life. And so again, I think you look at those millennials and they already have that. They've got that kind of fluidity and impermeability. They've got porous boundaries all around them. Brought about in large part by being digital natives. And I think that will make them rethink the relationship. And we worry about boundary setting and checking emails on a Sunday morning and the stress that you can get if something that's a problem at work pops up in your downtime. That's with the equality piece, I think, are the two things that could be the key drivers of the work rethink that we're looking at, because you've got to protect yourself from incursions which will make you ill, but at the same time you need to, in the digital world, make your skills and your expertise available when it's needed.
I mean, I've been predicting for a long time, and I remember people telling me that I was completely wrong, completely crazy, but I've been for a long time that this kind of industrial age model that we have for business that seems at the moment ubiquitous. I mean, it seems like it's always been there, which of course it hasn't, and it will always continue to be there. That is going to die. I have no doubt about it, that model is unsustainable. Companies of 60,000, 100,000 people working globally, trying to eke out little tiny profits for their shareholders, you know, year on year. I cannot see how that is sustainable for all sorts of reasons. But what I find really, really exciting, I guess, about what you're saying is that some of the change that needs to happen would be driven by people who want a life. So it's not just driven by, well, the change in technology or customer expectations or any of those kind of things, but actually by human beings saying, I actually want to have a life. I want to work. I love the work I do. I love making a contribution. I want to make a difference. I want to succeed, but I don't want to do it at the expense of everything else that matters to me, and that might drive more of a revolution than, say, technology, which actually is a tool for that, but not the driver for that.
Yes, I think technology is like flexible working. It's the tool, but the driver is what people want. And I think that there is a younger generation who do want much greater flexibility. I don't mean flexible working. They just want to live their lives. They're quite values based. I mean, obviously, I think this conversation might sound really annoying if you're a care worker or something. You think, well, where's my life and who's valuing that? But my hope is that as we rethink the industrial model, we'll also rethink what kind of work is valued, because there are so many jobs. You know, there are so many jobs which are fundamental to the functioning of society. I mean, here we are celebrating the NHS's foundation year, and technology has made huge changes to the way that NHS staff work, but actually it all comes down to, you know, the fundamentals are person-to-person care. It's hands-on, it's humanity, it's empathy, it's, you know, so much of curing somebody is about caring for them. So there, it's not about getting rid of an industrial model which is shareholder value-based. It is again about saying we need to deliver the highest quality service. We have a financial budget, we have a time budget, we have a people budget. And it's the people budget where I think if we started with the people budget and said meaningfully, people are our greatest asset. So you say, how are we going to support the people we employ so that they can give of their best? So I think the first thing you say is, how do we manage the time around those people for those people? And then, of course, you're saying, and how do we manage our organizational budget so that they're fairly rewarded in cash terms, so that they're not struggling? But I do think it just needs to go the other way around. We've spent the last century and a half putting the profit first and the people last, and we need to flip that over. And the end result will be greater profitability, I think, but it may be a different kind of profitability.
So as a business owner, or as a senior leader in business, those are some of the questions that one ought to be asking. As an individual who is at the sharp end of this burnout and this feeling that you can't give anything that your best, including your kids, and I mean, we haven't even talked about aging parents or sick relatives or any of the other responsibilities that you might have, you know, depending on your life circumstances. For as an individual, what can you do to start to get this, I guess it's balance, but I mean more inner balance, right?
Maybe balance isn't quite the right word. Again, I'm thinking about some of the lower paid people that we work with. They might well not recognize the word balance. They might think that that is a pretty middle class luxury thing to be thinking about. I think it might be more practical to say, what can you do to, oh, I'm about to say, get the balance between work and home right. What is it? What can you do to make your work for you? And I think the very first thing you do is you remember that you're the expert. You're the expert about your own life, and you're very much the expert about your job. You do actually know your job better than your manager does. And therefore, I think it's about giving yourself enough time to think about, is there anything that can be done to change your job? You know, if the hours are too long or the demands are too high, what's the conversation that you can have with your manager? And what are the compromises you're prepared to make? So, you know, we see in the index that, you know, a large number of fathers and mothers are making compromises which may well be income related, but they may not be. It may be that you can earn the same money for a better employer. A lot of the parents are just saying, we want to go to an employer who is family friendly. So look around, think about, you know, what's the time you really need? Where do you need to be and when? What do your kids and your partner, what does your partner need from you? If your job is not delivering that, if you have the confidence to have the conversation on your own, great, go do it. Go and look on the Working Families website, where there is masses of guidance about how to think about flexible working and how to make a request. If you're really having trouble, there's a Working Families helpline, which you can, is again on the website, give us a call and we can help coach you through making your case to your manager. I think the real thing is to be, try and be as really realistic as possible. Just pragmatism is all in this. So what is like, what will work for your job, and understand what your manager's trying to achieve, because if you go in being unrealistic, they'll just say no and, you know, you've blown your credibility.
I think that that is, it always a bit risky to do, but I mean, I don't know if you have any firm evidence on this. I know anecdotally that the clients of mine and people that I know that have come face to face with this and actually decided to do something about it rather than just tolerating what's basically tolerable have found that there are solutions, often quite creative solutions, that they and their employer can come up with together. And sometimes it's just a little thing. It doesn't have to be a whole rework of your whole contract or a whole redesign of the job. It can be something small, some boundary that gets put in place that makes all the difference to your quality of life.
No, definitely. I mean, I can think of one person who had a big, you know, senior job. And for various reasons, he absolutely was never going to be available on a Friday. And he luckily had a, luckily we should try and get away from the luck thing on this, but his immediate boss was supportive of that. So the immediate boss knew that if it was life and death, obviously he could get a message to him, he'd respond. But actually it meant that his team had an acting up opportunity. So it worked for the people he was managing because it allowed them to get more experience and more confidence. So they were great. They were a greater asset for his organization. It can work. It can be a much smaller change than not working on a Friday. I mean, it really can be the classic one about coming in at 9:30 instead of 9 and working a half hour lunch hour. And that is the sort of change that a reasonable manager should be able to agree to, especially if you've talked through with your other teammates, because the real, what managers hate is unilateral or bilateral discussions where somebody comes and says, I want to do this. And then the manager has to think through, well, what's the impact on colleagues going to be? How's the team going to manage this? Really good organizations or really good teams within organizations set up team protocols. What does flexible working mean to us in our work situation? So it could be that you're running a service, which is a 9-to-5 service. And so you're just thinking about, okay, how can we support maybe 3 of us within 8 have got school drop-offs to do. So how do we manage that through the week? Or it could be that you're in some big heavy duty transactional role and the deal within the team is at the end of a deal, we all get the weekend off. Or even UBS in one of their, I think it's the fund managers, but it's one of the fairly high stress, very macho bits of UBS have come up with a scheme called Take Two, which means you're allowed 2 hours out through the week. Just, you know, you take it, and it's being modelled by the leaders who will say, I'm doing my Take Two now. And whether that's to go do something with the kids or go to the dentist, whatever it is, it just, you know, they've agreed it together, and so it works for them. It's that sense of having control. But I would say you should remember that you have legal rights, particularly if you've got caring responsibilities. So that's another reason to be ringing our helpline, because it may be that there is a discrimination issue going on. You don't want to go down that route, but you do have that as a fallback. And I think the other thing to say is don't do it on your own. If you're in a couple relationship, look at what both of you can be doing. You know, people do internalize this and think I've got to struggle on, but perhaps, you know, because what we do see is, I just saw it this morning, I nipped down to the shops and I saw a couple across the road. He was taking the kids to daycare and she was heading off to work. And I'm sure they flipped that round because they've both got, you know, full-time jobs. So there you go, it can be done.
And it's, you know, not everyone has kids and not everyone has these kind of heavy duty caring responsibilities. But I think what you're saying is that if we can also, by taking individual action from a personal perspective, and when organizations see the value of giving people a life, that benefits. I mean, I remember when I was at the BBC, I didn't have children. I was always expected to take my summer holidays, not in the summer. And I was expected to work over Christmas and New Year because I didn't have kids, and therefore the people that did have kids had the priority. Flexible working was not available to me because it was only available to parents. And I think if we can have more of a culture change, driven maybe by individuals, maybe driven by millennial men, if that's what's required, then that's going to benefit everybody, no matter what their personal circumstances.
I think that's so true, because we even now struggle with people who don't have care responsibilities feeling resentful, because they just feel that the changes that have happened to date favour only one section of the workforce. The flip side of it is we see parents feeling tremendous guilt. We're about to publish a report on parents with disabled children, and it's the same findings, that people with a disabled child, they may have flexible working, but they often end up resigning because they feel that they're asking their colleagues to cover and carry too much. So, you know, you've got, on the one hand, care responsibilities can be absolutely non-negotiable. On the other hand, people with care responsibilities take those responsibilities and their responsibilities at work and to their colleagues very, very seriously. Then that's, you know, you're coming back to it. Why do people feel stressed? Well, because they're being pulled in impossible directions.
A lot of people listening to this show are at something of a crossroads in their life. And I know you are too. After more than 20 years at Working Families, you're going to be going off in a new direction. How does that feel?
That feels amazing. It's 24 years, which is incredible. And it feels very exciting. I am hoping that I will be able to forge my own path as somebody who will go and speak and commentate and write on these issues that I feel so passionately about, because they, you know, they've run through both my personal life and my professional life for the last 24 years. It's obviously pretty, you know, I'm nervous because I've had the both the protection and the strength of Working Families behind me. So doing it all for myself, well, you've done it, so terrific. You know how it is, and you look great on it, and you're obviously having a ball doing it. So that's what I'm hoping my next decade is going to be. I'm going to hand Working Families on to somebody who I'm absolutely have no doubt that my successor will make a huge success of it. Working Families is 40 years old next year. So we have, as Working Families, a new decade to look at and new challenges. And I personally have a new decade and new challenges. Bring it on.
Well, I know that you're going to have a fantastic time. What an adventure. I think it's going to be amazing. And I just, you know, I was looking at all the data that you've collected over the years and the changes that we've seen in the time that you've been involved in Working Families, for instance. It is huge. When you step back and look at what life is like, and the policies that are now commonplace in most organisations, it really is extraordinary. And I hope you feel very proud of the part you've played in that.
I do, thank you, because it has changed. I just think, you know, 1994, flexible working was about part-time working for women. That was it. That's what we were talking about. And childcare, which actually we need to get back to because not enough is being done on childcare. But that was essentially what the agenda was. And we really have, you know, within Working Families and with all our fellow campaigners, we're in a different place now. With this generation, which has such wonderful ambitions for themselves as parents and as workers, it's brilliant.
Oh, I love Sarah's optimism. So many powerful reasons to change the way we work. If you run a business, or if you're a senior leader in a business, I see no reason why you can't start experimenting with 4-day weeks for the same pay, making jobs human-sized, working more closely with people in your company to figure out how they can contribute to the business and still have a life. In fact, If you don't, you're going to have a big problem, specifically in the next 5-10 years when you look around and all the millennial men and women have chosen to have a life rather than to work for you. As an individual, this interview should also have given you cause for optimism. If you're actively looking for ways to create more balance, you're at the forefront of a movement that's about to go mainstream. You're carving the way for a revolution, and future generations will thank you for that. That's it for this week. Back next week with another really great interview, actually, also about balance, particularly when you feel very, very busy. How to get organized, how to find that balance when there's so much to do. So that's next week, but do please check out the Working Families website. All the details are in the notes for this show. And please also stay in touch with us and with information about how to do that. Here is the absolutely delightful Ivy Palmer.
To hear from you, you can get all the episodes of this show, plus read the blog and find out more about our travel adventure at www.brilliantgamble.com. Sign up to the newsletter and get an advance notice of the classes and programs Mummy is running. Plus, you can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Brilliant Gamble. Finally, please leave a review and star rating for this podcast on iTunes, as it helps people find us and take a brilliant gamble of their own.